Hick is out, Cuomo goes berserk, and King talks rape and incest. It's a Let's Chill Out at Yasgur's Farm edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Democrats got burned in 1994 over the assault weapons ban, but this time they say will be different.
The way political culture changes is it comes from the bottom up, all over the country, from Florida to Connecticut to Washington State, etc. There have just been a whole lot of new restrictions placed on guns in those states, and I think that that will push Washington.
Plus, Kirsten Gillibrand continues to take heat for her role in pushing Al Franken out the Senate door.
I think she's hurt herself politically. She has alienated potential supporters. She is seen as someone who perhaps prematurely jumped on Al Franken rather than letting a process play out.
And John Hickenlooper finally bows to reality. Now the question is, will it be Senator Hickenlooper?
It kept coming up, people recommending that he run for the Senate. But clearly, as this race has wound down, there's a group that's starting to raise funds for him. So I think the pressure is beginning to build to encourage him to run.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 290 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Welcome to the dog days of summer and the dog days of politics as well. Horrific instances of gun violence that desperately call for adult leadership have instead sunk to petty grievances, finger-pointing, and self-aggrandizement. We'll start with a vintage Donald Trump moment when he arrived in El Paso and visited the hospital where survivors to the Walmart shootings were being treated and said this to a room of emergency workers.
I was here 3 months ago. We made a speech and we had a what was the name of the arena? That place was packed, right? That was some crowd.
Thank you.
And we had twice the number outside. And then you had this crazy Beto. Beto had like 400 people in a parking lot. They said his crowd was wonderful.
And then Trump, always a promoter of conspiracy theories, decided to retweet a post that tied Bill Clinton to the death of Jeffrey Epstein. Trump was asked about it by a reporter.
Do you really think the Clintons are involved in Jeffrey Epstein's death?
I have no idea. I know he was on his plane 27 times, and he said he was on the plane 4 times. But when they checked the plane log, Bill Clinton, who is a very good friend of Epstein, he was on the plane about 27 or 28 times. So why did he say 4 times? And then the question you have to ask is, did Bill Clinton go to the island? Because Epstein had an island. That was not a good place, as I understand it, and I was never there. So you have to ask, did Bill Clinton go to the island? That's the question. If you find that out, you're going to know a lot.
This is how far we've fallen. Hopefully, though, Ted Cruz's father and Lee Harvey Oswald will get to the bottom of it. And Steve King is back at it. The Iowa Republican congressman, who was stripped of all committee assignments by the GOP for comments he made about white supremacism, stoked more controversy on Wednesday. The anti-abortion conservative suggested there might not be, quote, any population of the world left if it were not for rape and incest.
What if it was okay, and what if we went back through all the family trees and just pulled those people out that were products of rape and incest? Would there be any population of the world left if we did that?
House Republican leaders once again denounced his comments, with Wyoming's Liz Cheney, number 3 in the party hierarchy, once again calling for his resignation. Meanwhile, Curt Schilling, the former Major League Baseball pitcher who won a World Series with the Arizona Diamondbacks, has been quoted as saying he is absolutely considering running for Congress in Arizona next year. An outspoken conservative and strong Trump supporter, Schilling also won a World Series title with the Boston Red Sox. And this all leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last person to serve in Congress and win a World Series title? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. will select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
I'm talking baseball, Klazuski, Campanella, talking baseball. The man and Bobby Feller, the scooter, the barber, and the duke. They knew them all from Boston to Dubuque, especially Willie, Mickey, and the Duke.
Democrats, it is fair to say, have long had a complicated relationship with guns. Yes, their party, unlike the Republicans, is always the first to call for some kind of restrictions on gun ownership following a gun-related tragedy. But it hasn't always benefited them politically. When President Clinton signed the assault weapons ban in 1994, he said it was a new day for America.
This day is the beginning, not the end, of our effort to restore safety and security to the people of this country.
But the ban was widely cited to be among the reasons why the Democrats took a shellacking in the 1994 midterms. Those Democrats who continued to fight for gun legislation, like Vice President Al Gore, never escaped the crosshairs of the National Rifle Association. In 2000, as Gore was running for president, he got a warning from NRA President Charlton Heston, who was gripping a rifle over his head.
I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
When the NRA spent millions in the successful effort to defeat Gore that year, especially in the then swing states of West Virginia and Tennessee, the message was clear. You stand up to the gun lobby at your own peril. And that led to some conflicting messages from the Democrats. In 2008, in her effort to overtake Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, long considered a strong proponent of gun control, started talking about the sanctity of the Second Amendment and how she was taught how to shoot by her grandfather. In the first 2 years of the Obama administration, when Democrats had large majorities in both the House and Senate, there was not a single vote taken about guns. After the unspeakable killings of second and third graders at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012, the Senate, still under Democratic control, held a vote on Dianne Feinstein's assault weapons ban. The ban received just 40 votes in a Senate with 55 Democratic members. Conventional wisdom has been telling us, after every gun-caused atrocity, nothing is going to get done in Congress. But this time, say Democrats, it's different. El Paso and Dayton made it different, they insist. Anna Greenberg is the managing partner at GQR, a Democratic polling firm. She co-wrote an op-ed in Sunday's Washington Post with the headline, "America is finally turning against guns." Anna, thanks so much for being on The Political Junkie.
Oh, it's a pleasure being here. I'm trying to get over listening to Moses talking about taking a gun out of his cold, dead hand.
I think what I'm most curious about, and I guess this is going back to your op-ed, is why, in your view, is this different? Like, why wasn't Las Vegas different, or Parkland, or Charleston, or Orlando, or, and for God's sake, Sandy Hook? Why weren't those different?
I think there needed to be a number of things in place for the more recent shootings to be different, which is to say, you know, if you think about what came before Sandy Hook, there really weren't strong voices in Washington advocating for restrictions on guns. Certainly the Brady campaign against gun violence existed. There are certainly like local groups. It wasn't that there wasn't anybody who was championing, gun control, but they're pretty few and far between, pretty local, and not really voices in Congress. And after Sandy Hook, while we didn't see legislative action in the Senate, Manchin-Toomey also failed, we actually saw a really revitalized movement on the left, you know, among Democrats and progressives to try to enact more restrictions on guns. So you had Michael Bloomberg's effort, Mayors Against Illegal Guns, now called Everytown. They had been starting to get active. You had Gabby Gifford start a group that is now called Gifford's Courage, getting active. You had, you know, the Brady campaign actually start to also revitalize in terms of fundraising. And you start having an actual movement after, you know, really, you know, at least 10, 15 years of absence, a real movement, you know, and a real voice calling for efforts to reform guns. So it's not like what's happening now came out of nowhere. There have been 4 or 5 years of a building movement that's both in Washington and at the grassroots. The other thing that's happened is that there's been changes at the state level. There have been, I think, like over 300 restriction and pass on guns at the state level post Sandy Hook. And one of the things that we know about how political change happens in this country is that it often happens from the bottom up. In other words, if you look at something like marriage equality or legalizing marijuana, it's what happens at the state level and with activism that ends up bubbling up and pressuring Washington. And so after, you know, and I would also say that it isn't just Dayton and El Paso, but the Parkland shooting was also a real catalyst. For instance, after the Parkland shooting, you saw Governor Rick Scott pass, you know, not significant or dramatic, but real pieces of gun control legislation around waiting periods and the age you can be to purchase a gun. And so Parkland was also a real moment that I think was very similar to Dayton and El Paso. But none of this happened overnight. There was years, you know, post Sandy Hook of a revitalized movement, things passing at the state level across the country through legislatures and ballot initiatives. And what happens is the pressure builds from the bottom up to the point where you have to start imagining seeing action, you know, in Washington.
Okay, now, in addition to everything you're saying, and I want to talk about the action in Washington in a second, but in addition to everything you're saying, we've also been showing polls showing a clear majority, including among Republicans, in favor of background checks. And that's been going for a while now, is that correct?
Yes, I mean, background checks have never been particularly controversial. And certainly the gun control movement for a long time has been calling for closing what they call the gun show loophole, which is to say, if you're a licensed dealer under federal law, you have to conduct a background check. But if you are an unlicensed dealer at a gun show, you do not. And so it's easy enough for people to have criminal records to buy guns legally. And there are certain states that have done it. But nationally, at federal level, that is not the case. And so even gun owners, and I've done focus groups with NRA members and gun owners who say, look, you have to have a background check to work at a daycare center. You have to have a driver's license to drive a car. I don't see why, you know, if you're a law-abiding citizen, what's the big deal if you have to have a background check? It's a very small number, down to probably 5-10% of the people in this country think you don't need a background check. To me, what's more interesting is that we're seeing a change on more significant restrictions on guns, more support for assault weapon ban, which is now at about 60-65%, depending on the poll, limits on high-capacity magazines, support for federal licensing. All of these much, well, I don't personally find them onerous, but some of these more aggressive efforts to control access to guns, that's where you see the mass shootings really pushing public opinion to a different place.
Do you think it's fair, my characterization of the Democratic Party's role in all of this, saying that it had not been, maybe because of what happened after 94, maybe what after 2000, what after we saw the first 2 years of Obama, but is it fair to say that the Democrats have been a little, I mean, I don't mean to say gun shy as a pun, because there's nothing funny about this, but I mean, were they a little politically wary of pushing this issue historically?
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't think there was much discussion of it in the 2004 presidential between Kerry and Bush, and in 2006, famously, you know, Rahm Emanuel, who was the head of the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, you know, recruited rural conservative Democrats to run for office, who were, many of whom were, you know, for lack of a better way to say it, pro-gun. And a lot of them won. He's Shuler, for example, in North Carolina. A lot of them won seats in Congress, and you had, you know, a more conservative set of Democrats when the Democrats took over in 2006. And, you know, Democrats did a lot of progressive things, especially when in the 2 years that they controlled Congress along with Obama around health care and the like. But they didn't really do anything on guns, in part because there were big chunks of the party who were, you know, pro-gun. That's not really true anymore. A lot of those blue dogs lost, you know, in 2010. And a lot of the new Democrats who've been elected who are coming from suburban districts that had been Republican districts but are sort of trending Democratic. And very, very, you know, the suburban areas of this country are very much in favor of restrictions on access to guns. And so the makeup of the Democratic Party in the House has changed. Of course, you know, the problem remains the Senate. And if you look at the Manchin-Toomey legislation, which was a background check bill, you had red state Democrats voting against it, like Heidi Heitkamp. Well, they're all gone. And so if Democrats take back the Senate, the kind of the red, and of course, you know, Joe Manchin, who is a red state Democrat, was one of the co-sponsors. A lot of the red state Democrats in the Senate who voted against these pieces of legislation are not going to be in the Senate anymore. You're going to have Democrats from states that are changing, like Arizona and those kinds of places that are becoming more Democratic.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, speaking about the difference between the House and Senate, Democrats have been pointing out, rightfully so, that the Democratic House passed two measures earlier this year that call for background checks, but Mitch McConnell has refused to act on them. Now, I know, you know, there are a lot of hints from President Trump and from Mitch McConnell that they're considering such measures. But when all is said and done, do you think the Senate is going to act?
No, I think it's going to, I think if they do something, it'll be something at the margins. I mean, certainly, you know, President Trump called for, after Las Vegas, ban on bump stocks. So I don't think it's impossible. I think that was done by executive order. I'm not entirely sure. So I don't think it's impossible that something small will happen, but I think we'll have to wait till Democrats at least are in the White House. But I think there's a lot of hints that Republicans get, certainly for some of them, on, I think, an emotional and moral level. So Representative Turner, who represents Dayton, Ohio, who has 93%.
Right, Mike Turner.
Mike Turner has a 93%, you know, a rating from the NRA, came out for a ban on assault weapons. Governor of the state of Ohio, you know, put out a 17-point, you know, plan on restrictions on guns. You know, I mentioned Governor Scott, Congressman Mast from the Florida with 18 reported gun shooting came out against assault weapons, and he's actually a veteran. And so there are Republicans in states where these things happen who, you know, find religion, if you will, on guns. And I think that McConnell as well, and even to some degree the president, seem to be aware that they're sort of on the wrong side of history and trying to make, you know, sort of make nice. That's actually a significant change. Like, I welcome Republicans starting to understand it's going to be a political problem for them to be opposed to any effort to place restrictions on guns. And by the way, I would add that the NRA is greatly weakened as a power against efforts to restrict access to guns. They're collapsing internally with infighting and mismanagement. But they also are kind of less powerful than people think they are. If you actually look at the amount of money and the amount of soft money there is in politics, they spend a fraction of what, say, the Kochs spend through their super PACs. And so the kind of scary idea that the NRA will come after you electorally, they're kind of a paper tiger.
I have to interrupt you now because I keep thinking about what President Trump said last year after the massacre at Parkland High School. Let me play that piece of tape.
There's nobody that loves the Second Amendment more than I do, and there's nobody that respects the NRA. They're friends of mine. They backed us all. They're great people. They're patriots. But they're great people. But we really do have to strengthen up background checks. We have to do that.
So he said that, and then a week or so later, he met with the NRA, and then he never said the word background checks again until this year, after El Paso said, well, you know, we should have background checks. And then, I mean, like everything, he says it. It seems like he says it at the time because it's the right thing to say. It's an emotional a point in the conversation, and then it just disappears. That's why I think I'm less optimistic than many people are that President Trump is really serious about this.
Oh, he's not. And like I said, I think we have to have a Democratic president and or a Democratic Senate for anything to really happen. But you have to keep in mind that guns and the Second Amendment are critical to the dark web communication with the base. Trump supporters. And so, you know, we could have a whole episode on the dark web and the far right content on the web, but Second Amendment rights, quote unquote, and access to guns are and linking it with patriotism are a huge part of the content that both the far right in this country and the people making the shift from Russia and Bulgaria and all those places, it's a huge part of their content. And so for Trump, and that's a big part of how Trump obviously won in 2016, as we know, And for Trump to sort of disavow the NRA or to do anything real on this is a real problem from that perspective. It has nothing to do with policy and public opinion. It has everything to do with how the base, the Trump base is intricately intertwined with a sort of pro-gun, pro-Second Amendment, and also has sort of how it's thought of culturally. So he can't afford to disavow the NRA or the Second Amendment. So I agree. I don't think he's going to do anything. But I think there's a dark underbelly of the internet that is the where guns plays a huge role in keeping his support solid.
You know, you mentioned about that maybe perhaps nothing will get done until and unless there's a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president. I want to play a piece of tape from this is just fascinates me. In 2016, when the Democratic presidential field was, shall we say, slightly smaller, you had this coming from one of the candidates, Martin O'Malley, which was directed at the two frontrunners.
Senator Sanders voted against the Brady Bill. Senator Sanders voted to give immunity to gun dealers. And Senator Sanders voted against even research dollars to look into this public health issue. Secretary Clinton changes her position on this every election year, it seems, having one position in 2000 and then campaigning against President Obama and saying we don't need federal standards.
Whatever you think, Anna, whatever you think of O'Malley's argument back then, it seems like every Democratic candidate, including Sanders, is touting his or her proposals on gun restrictions, and not just background checks, you know, gun buybacks and gun licensing and again, the ban on assault weapons. And you called some of those candidates out by name in your post-op-ed. So it certainly, it seems, even going back as recently as 2016, it seems to be a different Democratic Party.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's a different Democratic primary. There's no question that there's unanimity across the stage, if you will, these debate stages around every, you know, from background checks to assault, you know, weapons and others who would do more. And it would be put you completely out of the mainstream if you were not to be for those things. But I think for Democratic primary voters in the polling I've done, their top three issues are healthcare, guns, and climate. And so they're also reflecting where Democratic primary voters are. But in the past, had you asked Democratic primary voters about a whole range of restrictions on guns, they would have been all for it. So, I mean, this is a case where the public has led the elites, I think. And it's to my point about, you know, people like McConnell and Lindsey Graham and Trump paying lip service, which won't amount to anything. Even they understand where public opinion is. So my view is that the public's been in a different place on guns for a long time, and it's taken a long time for the political establishment to catch up to where they are.
Let me just end with this one thought, and I say this all the time, and I never get tired of hearing it from myself because it just seems to hit home with me. Like, and I would always say that if Congress didn't act after 6- and 7-year-olds are gunned down, when would they ever? But I'm hearing more hopeful thoughts, more optimism than I've ever heard before. Is that fair?
I think that's fair, and I think you should be. I'll go back to what I said before. 300 laws have been passed at the state level since Sandy Hook, and the state leads the nation, and in almost all things. Sometimes the other way around, like Brown versus Board of Education, for example. But in many of these things, the way political culture changes is it comes from the bottom up. And so if you look at what's happened in states all over the country, from Florida to Connecticut to Washington State, et cetera, there have just been a whole lot of new restrictions placed on guns in those states. And I think that will push Washington once there's Democratic leadership in Washington.
Anna Greenberg is the managing partner at GQR, a Democratic polling firm. Anna, thank you for taking time away from your vacation to be on the show.
My pleasure.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Look how I'm living now. Police be tripping now. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area. I got the strap.
By most accounts, Kirsten Gillibrand has had a charmed political career. When she first ran for the House in 2006 in an upstate New York district that was historically Republican, she was not supposed to win. But just days before the election, it was revealed that the GOP incumbent, John Sweeney, was accused of assaulting his wife the year before. It turned the tide and led to a narrow Gillibrand win. In 2009, after Senator Hillary Clinton was picked by Barack Obama to be his Secretary of State, Governor David Paterson surprised many people and named Gillibrand to succeed her.
She is dynamic, she is articulate, she is perceptive, she is courageous, she is outspoken. I am appointing her to the United States Senate, representing New York today. Please welcome our next senator and current Congresswoman Kirsten Gillibrand.
She was overwhelmingly elected in 2010 to fill Clinton's term, and 2 years later, she was reelected with more than 72% of the vote, the largest victory margin of anyone running statewide in New York history. Fighting for women's rights, she played a leading role in the Me Too movement, and it led to her joining the 2020 presidential field. But one of the reasons her campaign has yet to take off, one of the reasons she's trailing in the polls and with campaign contributions, is the role she played in urging Senator Al Franken, a Minnesota Democrat and liberal darling, who had been accused by numerous women of an inappropriate behavior, to resign his seat.
Enough is enough. I mean, this is a conversation we've been having for a very long time, and it's a conversation that this country needs to have. And I think when we start having to talk about the differences between sexual assault and sexual harassment and unwanted groping, you are having the wrong conversation. You need to draw a line in the sand and say none of it is okay, none of it is acceptable, and we, as elected leaders, should absolutely be held to a higher standard, not a lower standard, and we should fundamentally be valuing women. And that is where this debate has to go.
And Gillibrand has never backed down from that position. Here she is at a recent town hall meeting sponsored by MSNBC.
Now, I am a mother of boys. And the conversations I was having at home at the time were very upsetting. Because Theo said to me, "Mom, why are you so tough on Al Franken?" And as a mother, I had to be really clear. It is not okay for anyone to grope a woman anywhere on her body without her consent. It is not okay to forcibly kiss a woman ever without her consent. It was not okay for Senator Franken, and it was not okay for you, Theo, ever. So I needed to have clarity. And if there are a few Democratic powerful donors who are angry because I stood up for women who came forward with allegations of sexual harassment, that's on them.
But the fact is, her candidacy is not catching on, and many attribute it to the residual anger by some for her role in Franken's departure. As a political observer from Minnesota, Larry Jacobs is perhaps watching this closer than most. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance in the Hubert H. Humphrey School and the Department of Political Science at the University of Minnesota. Larry, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Good to be with you.
Well, before we get to Kirsten Gillibrand, what's the current view of Al Franken in Minnesota?
Well, I think there are a lot of folks, and particularly the type of progressive Democrats who vote in Democratic primaries, who are mournful. Al Franken was replaced by Tina Smith, who's well-regarded, but not as well-known and certainly not as gifted as Al Franken in terms of the searing public displays that Al Franken exhibited in hearings on the Judiciary Committee and in other settings. So I think, you know, the word, very simply, is people miss Al Franken. They miss his voice, and they feel like he was wronged.
I was going to say, do they feel he was railroaded out of a job?
Well, that's certainly the view of progressives in Minnesota and I think around the country. There was a recent piece by Jane Mayer in The New Yorker who revisits some of these allegations, and I think the conclusion from that piece is that Al Franken was railroaded. Not that he was innocent of inappropriate comments or actions, but that the ways in which it was portrayed was overdone. I do think this has landed on Kirsten Gillibrand's shoulders. She is seen as someone who perhaps prematurely jumped on Al Franken rather than letting a process play out, that Al Franken may have been blamed for things that actually didn't occur, but that she, that is, the senator, gave voice to, and that the treatment and the punishment didn't fit whatever crime there was. And what I've heard countless progressives say is, how can you compare Al Franken and his fooling around and joking around with the current occupant of the White House?
Well, actually, that's what Franken said on the Senate floor when he announced his resignation, that I am aware that I am leaving while that guy in the White House is still there. But several things you mentioned, and I think they're all important, they should be mentioned. One, the lack of due process, and that's been mentioned by a lot of supporters of Al Franken. But at the same time, eight women came forward to say that his behavior was inappropriate, and many said that his response was inadequate. And also, when you mentioned Gillibrand and the role she played in forcing his resignation, that's true, but we should also mention that some two dozen Democratic senators joined her. And in fact, nearly all the Democratic women except for Amy Klobuchar.
Yeah, though I think it's also worth noting that some of the more prominent women who had come out publicly against Al Franken have since said it was a mistake and they regret it. And I think as you dig in on those eight women, what they said and how they characterized the allegations against Al Franken have now subsequently received more scrutiny. And some of them, I think, are really dubious whether they happened or happened the way they were described. So I think both the charges seem in hindsight to be perhaps less alarming than the way the senator portrayed them. And I think the lack of due process and the kind of almost lynch mob that formed very quickly to chase Al Franken out of the Senate is something that's regretted. Then you add the fact that here was one of the most gifted progressive voices in the public arena, someone who could cut through the maelstrom of debate and really land his punch in a way that would get picked up on social media and become a kind of a rallying point for progressives. That's gone, and I think there are a lot of progressives who say, wow, we really miss Al Franken.
I remember thinking at the time, though, that some Democrats were saying that there was no way they can go after Alabama Republican Roy Moore on sexual misconduct charges if they weren't tough on Franken. In other words, they would be attacked for a double standard.
Yeah, that's certainly true, though I think the Senate was in the process of developing a fallback position, which is we've established a process and we're going to take the following steps to make sure it's a rigorous process such that the allegations against the senator could be heard and then any subsequent action. Senator Franken had actually agreed to participate and participate fully in that investigation. I think there was a way in which the Senate Democrats could have moved forward both in trying to win the Alabama seat and without such a precipitous conclusion about Al Franken, one that in hindsight may appear to be unfortunate.
You know, when Gillibrand made her stand against Al Franken, that was during the peak of the Me Too movement. And it was not only Al Franken she went after. She also said last November that Bill Clinton should have resigned the presidency for his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, and that didn't endear her too well with Clinton folks.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear that Kirsten Gillibrand's presidential campaign has gone nowhere. If you try to find polling numbers on her, good luck. She's even below 1 point. So a lot of times she's just getting kind of a dash mark. I think she's, you know, hurt herself politically. She has alienated potential supporters. And again, the key voters in the upcoming Democratic primaries are not a cross-section of America. They're overwhelmingly progressive liberal Democrats. And those are the people who pay attention more than most Americans and even more than most Democrats.
I think your point is very well taken, but I'm wrestling with the two things here. Here you have a progressive champion like Al Franken, and that voice is definitely missing. This is not a judgment on Tina Smith at all, but the fact that you've lost Al Franken, but at the same time, in this era of Me Too and you know things like that, there's no excuse for inappropriate behavior, whether it's the fact that eight women came forward, and we could talk about whether their cases have merit or not, but there's also that argument that was really going around the country at that time. So in other words, there's more gray than black and white, it seems to me.
Oh, for sure. And that's, I would absolutely agree with that. I think that's the, you know, regret. And again, I'm not an apologist for Al Franken. I think there were things he said and did that are regrettable and may well have deserved a significant sanction. But I think because there was gray area, the very quick way in which he was pushed out is the part that's unfortunate and points to the need for a bit more of a process as we sort through what is the evidence, what's the appropriate response, if there is going to be a penalty to what we've now discovered. And that wasn't the case with Franken. If you go back and you look at the chronology, it was remarkably fast. In fact, he was thinking about it over the weekend, and the Democratic leader, Schumer, was on the phone with him saying, I need your decision now. And that to me is really unfortunate.
And it's also led to residual anger, ongoing anger, with Kirsten Gillibrand.
Yes, clearly. And I think, you know, I wouldn't say Gillibrand's failure as a presidential candidate only stems from Al Franken. I think it's a contributing factor, and one that, in a process dominated by progressives, is something that is haunting her.
Larry Jacobs is a political scientist at the University of Minnesota. Larry, thanks so much for being on the program.
Good to be with you.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, in the wake of President Trump mistakenly offering his condolences to the people of Toledo, Ohio, when the horrific shootings were in Dayton, the question was, before Toledo, what was the last city incorrectly mentioned by the Trump administration as the scene of mass shootings? The answer, Bowling Green. That's what we heard from presidential counselor Kellyanne Conway 2 years ago on MSNBC.
I bet there was very little coverage. I bet it's brand new information to people that President Obama had a six-month ban on the Iraqi refugee program after two Iraqis came here to this country, were radicalized, and they were the masterminds behind the Bowling Green massacre. I mean, most people don't know that because it didn't get covered.
Our thoughts and prayers to those who lost their lives at Bowling Green. And the randomly selected winner is Bob Winfrey of Port Townsend, Washington. Bob wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Way down in Bowling Green, prettiest girls I've ever seen. A man in Kentucky sure is lucky to love down in Bowling Green. Bowling folks treat you kind. They let you think you're on the line. A man in Kentucky sure is lucky. In Bowling Green you walk your own line.
Back in March, not long after his 8 mostly successful years as Colorado's governor came to an end, John Hickenlooper announced he had a new job in mind.
I'm running for president because we need dreamers in Washington, but we also need to get things done. I've proven again and again I can bring people together to produce the progressive change Washington has failed to deliver. Join me, and we'll repair the damage done to our country and be stronger than ever.
But running as a centrist in a party that has moved to the left in recent years, Hickenlooper never got much traction. He did not leave any memorable footprints in the first two debates, and by the looks of things, he was going to have difficulty meeting the criteria to make it to the September debate. On Thursday, he bowed to reality and bowed out of the race.
I ran for president
because this country is being ripped apart by politics and partisan games while our biggest problems go unsolved. Now today, I'm ending my campaign for president, but I will never stop believing that America can only move forward when we work together.
And while Democrats in Colorado and around the country have been urging him to come home and run for the Senate, he has always dismissed that notion. "I'm not cut out to be a senator," he has said over and over again. Now that his White House dreams have come to an end, there's a new question on the table. Does he get into the Senate race? A new poll showed Hickenlooper with a 51-point lead over two Democrats already in the Senate race, where Republican Cory Gardner is seeking re-election and is thought to be vulnerable. Floyd Cerulli is a Colorado-based political pollster and consultant and the founder of Cerulli Associates. Floyd, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
It's good to be here today, Ken.
I guess we've known for some time now that John Hickenlooper was not going to be the 46th president of the United States.
Yes, we did. That start in March was really very upbeat. He managed to raise, I think, $1 million or more very quickly. It was remarked on that he had found a lot of support initially. Again, as you pointed out, he was very popular in leaving the state. He had actually thought about running for president. I don't know if you remember, but he and John Kasich got together in way back in 2017, talking about maybe a unity ticket. They were thinking about working on health care. He had been actually thinking about it and making some overtures well before the 4th. And so he started with, I thought, considerable momentum. He was popular in Colorado. But as you point out, the debate structured a great deal of this. The polls structured a great deal of it. The moderate position was also claimed, obviously, by Joe Biden, who really sort of dominates that position. And there were a number of others, moderates who, Congress persons and others who took that position. So he really was sort of crowded out. He never was able to get beyond 1 or 2% in the polls. And most recently, he's actually kind of faded. He didn't do anything very memorable in those two debates. And after the first debate, he admitted that he's not good at debates. And unfortunately, in this race, the debates really shape pretty much the landscape. And his failure there and in just being able to grab some national attention doomed this campaign. I thought it was obvious that he wasn't going to make the criteria that kicks in on the 28th for the September debate. So clearly we were sort of in a countdown as to when he would quit and how he would do it.
The only memorable moment I could think of him for the entire campaign is when he attacked socialists and socialism. Now, that got that got nothing but boos every time he mentioned it. He mentioned it at the California convention. He mentioned the debates, and you hear boos. And while he did get attention with that, that's clearly not where the Democratic Party has headed.
That's correct. The while there is clearly a there's a position for being a moderate, but Joe Biden has much of it. There are a number of others, Amy Klobuchar, that are sort of at least criticizing Medicare for All and some of the initiatives that have come from the left. But there's not that much room. In addition to that, to take it head on really sort of angered one of the most active grassroots groups in the party, and that's the Sanders sort of Warren group, who do endorse Medicare for All and some of the other very liberal programs that John has reservations about. And so that he ended up being sort of while he got some attention, he didn't get any traction. The polling repeatedly, even a presidential poll in Colorado, had Biden ahead and Warren and Sanders, and John came in about fifth or sixth.
In his own state.
In his own state, exactly. So it wasn't, it even wasn't playing there. In Colorado, frankly, we had a caucus system. We've now shifted to a primary, but we had a caucus system. And Bernie Sanders won it the last time with John endorsing Hillary Clinton, the establishment candidate. The first time John endorsed Hillary Clinton again, and Barack Obama won it. In other words, the grassroots of the party, even in Colorado, is more liberal than many of the positions he takes.
He has said in the past that he was not interested in the Senate. I suspect, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that seems to be changing. What are you hearing?
Well, that's exactly right. He was vehement about it, at least partially, of course. It was interfering with his somewhat quixotic, but nonetheless, I think, serious campaign for the president. He wanted to be taken seriously, and it kept coming up, people recommending that he run for the Senate. So I think he went out of his way to put it down and say, that's not me. I wouldn't do it. I'm an executive. I bring people together. I solve problems. I'm just not senatorial material. But clearly, as this race has wound down, he has began to take a look at it. And of course, as you pointed out, there was a very strong poll done by actually that particular poll was done by the Senate Democrats who are encouraging him to run. They would they love some of these people. It's not just John, as you know, but there are some other people they would love to get out of the presidential race and run. And he did well in that poll. And there's a group that's starting to raise funds for him. So I think, well, he said in his announcement that he's going to give it some thought. I think that the pressure is beginning to build to encourage him to run. It won't necessarily be smooth, however. As you well know, there's several people in that race already. They've raised, frankly, more money since the first of the year than he raised in his presidential race. And there are some interest groups. I was sort of referring to them, the Sanders people, some environmental groups, and others who will probably really not support him in a potential primary.
Well, you mentioned so many things here. Let me see if I can take them a few at a time. First of all, you know as well as anybody, probably more than anybody, how important the Colorado Senate race is for the Democrats nationwide, especially as they hope to take control, and especially given how vulnerable Cory Gardner is.
Cory Gardner is a very good candidate. He beat an incumbent Democratic senator in 2014.
Mark Udall.
You got it. But it is assumed, frankly, that he is one of the most vulnerable Republican senators in the country. And it's because the state has really shifted. Even since Hickenlooper has been in office, the massive growth of millennials in the last decade, mostly registering unaffiliated, but mostly voting Democratic, overwhelmingly gave Democrats a victory in 2018, the governorship, all the constitutional offices, a new congressional seat. And so it's pretty much assumed that he is in deep trouble. And in particular, Donald Trump isn't liked in the state. He lost by 5 points to Hillary Clinton, and there's no poll indicating that he would get any closer this time. So that is it is assumed that it's the most vulnerable seat, and that which is one reason why there's more than 10 Democrats already in the race.
And given the fact that you have so many Democrats already running and raising money, are we to assume that they're going to withdraw just because Hickenlooper gets in?
No. There's a couple of historical points on this. When Cory Gardner got in 2014, the Republican Party had been recruiting him. There were some people in the race, including some substantial people, but they helped clear the field.
Ken Buck was one of them, right?
You got it. Ken Buck was one of them, and they pretty much lined him up to get a congressional seat. But they got them, and they cleared the field. When John Hickenlooper ran for governor, the governor at that point had only served one term, Bill Ritter, and he decided to not run. The party establishment said, you've got to run. And he was sort of nominated by the establishment. No one else got in the race. Of course, he had name identification from being the mayor of Denver and money, financial support. And so he never had a primary.
And showering with his clothing on.
That's right. He runs very creative campaigns. That's one reason why he has been successful and popular in Colorado. Of course, you couldn't run one of those ads nationally. He needed one, frankly. His unusual personality played well with a certain style of advertising that he used in his mayoral race and gubernatorial races. And that's not going to happen this time. And in my view, I do not believe the party establishment can clear the field. Obviously, he comes in with many assets if he chooses to do this. But there are several of those candidates that have serious intentions and financial support. They've been in it a while, and I just don't see them. I think this is probably going to be a primary if he wants to do it.
And I know that polls have shown, I keep referring to polls, I know that polls have indicated that Coloradans feel he did a good job as governor, but I do know as well that liberals were always not thrilled with his mostly moderate positions on, let's say, guns and energy.
You're right. He actually won his two elections for governor with only, I think, once 49% and the second time 51%. Relatively close races, or actually in reverse, he won the first one with 51 and the second one with 49, but close races. And there are major groups in the state did not like his positions, the environmental community in particular, especially those that are the most vehement anti-frackers. When he was out giving a speech at the National Convention in Philadelphia in 2016, they actually showed up and booed him and created a bit of a ruckus. They don't support him. I know that the Sanders groups over the years have, and of course, he, as you point out, he specifically criticized Sanders. They won't support him, and they're one of the most powerful grassroots groups in the state. And I would say also the teachers union will not be supportive, and they are the most powerful union in the state, mainly because of charter schools, his position on charter schools, or at least let's put it this way, they'll have another candidate to start with. They may ultimately end up being supportive, but not initially. So there is going to be significant elements of the party that will are already either lined up with other candidates or will not support John.
So Floyd, I'm leaving you with three questions. One, does he run? Two, does he win the Democratic primary? And three, can he beat Cory Gardner?
Well, I think the last one is of the easiest, and that is that I think he would be in a very good year. I think he would be a strong candidate against Gardner. And I would say if it wasn't an exceptional year, I think Cory Gardner would hold his own even in Colorado. But I think that Donald Trump and just the way the turnout looks like it's going to shape up as one of the elections of the century, I think Cory Gardner will have a hard time. Frankly, I think he'll have a hard time against any of those candidates. But I do think Hickenlooper would win. Frankly, his winning the nomination, I think if to the extent that the money and at least name identification in a primary are going to be important, I think he would have a very, very good chance to win it. But frankly, that would depend to some extent on those interest groups we just described and whether he ran a better campaign for the Senate than he ran for president, which was not very inspiring and was mostly on a defensive in a lot of the interviews he did. You remember the capitalism interview probably with Morning Joe, where he sort of stumbled around as to whether or not he would defend capitalism. I honestly, I'm not certain that he's going to get in it. I think there's this presumption has now been built up that he is going to get in it. I think it's still open. I think he's actually going to test it to see if that poll that said that he was ahead is based on something more than just name identification. And then fundamentally, do you want to take on a primary? He hasn't had one like this in a partisan primary. I don't think, let's put it this way, I don't think he wanted to. Or wants to. He was doing everything he could to not get in that race, the Senate race, and now it looks like it's beginning to loom in front of him. He's going to get powerful encouragement to do so. I think the party establishment is desperate for him to do so, and I guess I will be surprised if he doesn't take the leap, but I think it is going to be hazardous.
But he does have several months, at least, to make a decision, correct?
I agree with you. He definitely does. Cory Gardner didn't decide until February of 14. His problem, however, is that these other candidates are really seriously getting in this race. And as I mentioned, these interest groups may start to align very quickly. I think to some extent the pressure is going to be, if he's going to do this, I think the pressure is going to be on him to move very quickly and try to preempt them, talk some of them out of it possibly, but in any event, establish his base. I'm not sure he can just wait for months.
Floyd Cerulli heads up Cerulli Associates, a Colorado polling and consulting firm. Floyd, it was great having you on the show.
It was very good to be on it. What a topic. What a day.
What a day, exactly. Next week, we'll talk about Peter Dominik and Gordon Allett.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks, Floyd.
You got it.
Don't think that I don't think about Colorado. It's about the only thing I ever do. Don't think that I don't think about Colorado. Don't think I ain't thinking about you.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Don't think that I don't think about Colorado. Don't think I ain't thinking about you. I look back.